Now on RTE Radio 1, we present Lashings of Music, a documentary by Peter Brown on the life and times of the celebrated Ilian piper, Willie Clancy, who died in 1973. He is remembered every summer by a famous music festival, School Sarah Willie Clancy, in his hometown of Milltown Malbay in West Clare. The programme was first broadcast in 2002. Lashings of Music.
I do have a degree of envy of people who knew Willie, and I would like to have had that pleasure and privilege, because I've been involved in taking photographs at the summer school for such a long time now that crossed my mind many times that, you know, I would have liked to have known the man, heard his music from himself rather than from recordings. I saw a humorous piece a few years ago where it was the writer imagined the ghost of Willie Clancy actually coming back and visiting and looking around and trying to imagine what his reaction would be. The difference between then and now is just the amount of interest and the diversity of musicians, the youth of musicians. I mean, I was taking photographs today in Johnny Kelly's class, and I was describing it as more like a creche.
I always had that kind of hankering to have met him, you know, and kind of interesting looking at the photographs and so on. The odd time you hear him talking, and of course it all adds to the picture. But I was amazed. I was talking to somebody recently, and he was saying, "Oh yeah, we used to have lots of visitors to the house, Seamus Ennis and Joe Heaney and Big Willie Clancy." And I thought, "What do you mean Big Willie Clancy? Surely he wasn't, because the photographic image generally is certainly not a big man, you know, and maybe normal size or even small." But I was amazed to quite recently discover that he was quite a big man, you know. So, you know, it kind of highlights the fact that I didn't know him at all, you know.
It was felt then by various people who knew him and people who didn't know him and people who had heard his music. And I mean, the fact that they got together and started what became one of the best music festivals of the year. I mean, if Willie Clancy hadn't been there, something like that mightn't have happened.
I don't think he's remembered as well as he should be. I think there's an awful lot of people who listen to each other at the present time. They don't seem to, while they're supposedly playing traditional music, they don't avail of the sort of things that he availed of and that many others availed of, which is the recorded music, which gives you an insight into where the music you're playing today comes from. He's a name that's associated more with the summer school than with his own playing. And certainly I would like, and I think it's worthwhile from time to time, to bring his music in front of people and let people see just what a brilliant musician he was.
Like, it's an essential feature of this summer school. You have so many pipers who come here, and pipers who come from a long way away. When they come here, they must get these little problems sorted out so that they can participate effectively in the class. So it's an ideal surrounding that we have here. It's a very intensive activity. There's a lot of work done, a lot of demonstrations given, and a lot of very technical discussion, but for pipers and those who are initiating into the art, this is an essential feature of this entire week. And I think that Willie and the others who worked under difficult circumstances in the past would be literally thrilled at the advances that have been made over the last 20 years and the 30 years since Willie's death.
No, I mean, I can work on him later on.
I think it was worth going here. It's great. It's excellent. I'm going to this summer school, and I get a taste of the Irish music. I don't think I will learn it in 1 week, but I should be here for a longer time. It's a very small area, but if you're going from one part to another part, you will use an hour anyway, because you have to put your head into all the pubs where you can hear good music. I don't know very much about him, but I guess he was a good player, and I've seen at the poster that he was piping.
Well, last year I was here and I heard about the Willie Clancy School, so here I've come to the school, but I don't know anything about who Willie Clancy really was, you know. But his legacy, you know, it's like he started a complete movement, you know. I'm going to encourage everybody to come here. I tell my friends, you know, I tell them what the school involves and what is available to me. And then I tell them, guess how much it was? And they're like, what? And I was like, $120. They can't believe it. They're like, no way. Because you go to a flute class in the States, you go for like 4 days, it's like $1,000.
This is my 11th Willie Clancy summer school, and I'm here to teach the pipes, but I used to come down every year to take part in the pipes class. And it's also our annual family holiday. I know what his voice sounds like and what his pipe sounds like from the recordings and the LPs that we have at home. They're LPs that my father would have had before I was ever born. I'd have a fair idea of what his music sounded like, but I would have liked to have met him.
Willie Clancy holds a high place in the recent history of traditional Irish music. There are many people with fond personal memories of him, and others who didn't know him, but who are fascinated with his music. And every summer, at the music festival named in his honour, visitors come to learn about the continuing musical tradition of which Willie was an important part. Willie Clancy was born in 1918 in West County Clare, and his family roots were very much in that area.
He's descended from a long line of people who were, let's say, empowered in the area. I mean, one of his ancestors would have been the sheriff who did away with all those Spaniards who made it in from the Armada. And when you think about it, he, and if you look at his brother Pat, they have the requirements for it. They were big men. I mean, Willie was what? He was about 6'2", 6'3", well-built. And I think this was the thing that you needed back in, you know, in medieval and post-medieval times to gain a position of power like that. I mean, it sounds dreadful, I know. But as well as that, the family was consciously interested in culture. William Sev told me about manuscripts, seeing the uncle taking manuscripts down out of the scrawls, and he said the mouse droppings coming down with them. But they were consciously holding on to at least parts of a Gaelic culture. And he was quite conscious of it himself. And maybe that was a necessity, because Willie was a tradesman. And living in an area where your status is determined by the amount of land that you own, you possibly needed something to balance that out.
Well, I suppose his origins would be, I suppose, more rural than town, really. Because the Clancy family who lived in Island Bourne, outside of about 6 miles from Milltown, Melbourne, you know, the house that Willie's father came out of was a house which contained many Irish manuscripts. And still, there are still manuscripts there, actually. That's why maybe his interest in poetry and interest in literature, that he was conscious of that. And while he may not have understood, we'll say, the language, he realised and was, you know, very, very convinced that the way to go about even music was to acquire a good knowledge of the Irish language.
I think Willie Clancy was very aware of, extremely aware, because he was a very observant, intelligent, sensitive person, but he was very aware of the value of the tradition and, you know, the importance of tradition generally. You know, that tradition is something that's very hard won and takes a long, long time to evolve and mature. He was so aware of that whole business and the very fragile business of the transmission of a tradition in the direct way, Gareth Barry, Gilbert Clancy to Willie, and then feeling a part of that.
Well, tell me, Willie, have you always been a piper?
Well, it wasn't, and my father wasn't a piper, but he was a flute player, and the music was in the house. If we didn't have much of anything else, at least we had lessons of old music anyway. Mother played the old concertina.
And what was the first instrument you played?
Oh, the tin whistle, when I was about 5 years old, I believe. They tell me I don't remember it, scarcely remember it anyway. Somebody told me that he saw me playing a whistle in the town or village of Milton one night, he said the whistle was almost as big as yourself. So it must have been pretty humanised on it.
Well, can you remember what tunes you played in your early days?
Well, it's strange you should ask that now. I remember the very first tune I played. I thought it'd be very fascinating that this whistle was no bother at all, but really I suppose I wasn't too slow at it, because when I think of it now, I did start off with a difficult enough tune, which was Father O'Flynn, and it was a little bit much. I could have started on The Wearing of the Green or something simpler, but the father suggested this jig and I went ahead and learned it.
Well, that's as good a one as any to hear now, I would think.
Yeah, it's the first one I started on.
A big influence on Willie Clancy's music was a man he never met and who had died around the year 1900, the blind piper Garrett Barry.
His father talked so much to him, I suppose, about Garrett Barry. Some of the tunes, and they're so much the same, but they're so much different and there's so much quality injected into them. I've never asked him the question, where did he get all the tunes or why was his setting so different? And even some names like Banish Misfortune, The Shady Groves of Piemont and things like that. Many other tunes as well. I remember once when he was asked about his playing, you know, and how did you start? Well, he said, I got a fair grinding from my father. You know, and I said, that was a big start, but that was flute playing. And the flute playing would be the tunes as well that possibly that Garrett Barry played.
They were very good friends. He used to stay in their house in Allenvaughan. And because my grandmother loved music, he used to say he was a welcome, very welcome visitor when he came with the pipes. Quiet man, very musical. Poor Garrett died in his diamond, and for some reason or other, no one was coming forth to bury him, so my father made his coffin and buried him in the horse and car. Took him to Ine in the horse, the man's to Ine in the horse and car. I don't know if there were any other pipers around that my father mentioned, but it would be Garrett was what I always heard.
The father grew up. He went to work in the States for a certain amount of time in the 1880s. Came back around about the time that, in fact, Garrett Barry was dying in Ennis-Dymond. Certainly, the playing of that piper, Garrett Barry, left such an impression on the man that he tried to pass this onto Willie. In fact, when I met Willie first, it seemed like there was a ghost sitting at the table all the time, you know, to hear the way Willie was talking about it. I'd known Willie for about, I suppose, about a year, 18 months. So I got brave enough to say to him, Barry was a piper, but I never heard that your father actually played the pipes. I said, was he a piper as well? So he looked at me and he said, he could never afford a set of pipes. He played them in his head.
Probably as a result of that direct line, Willie would have acquired a lot of the settings of Garrett Barry's tunes and things, and he passed them on. And you could say only for Willie Clancy, possibly a lot of these would have been lost. And Garrett Barry, you know, while he would have been known, his music would have been unknown.
His father, Gilbert Clancy, did remember and had met Garrett Barry and had learned tunes from him. And these tunes were passed on to Willie Clancy. But he had an anecdote about the Feast of the Epiphany. And this was in different parts, which was certainly in Clare. And Garrett Barry believed this has to do also with the marriage feast of Cana, when Christ changed the water into wine, because they ran out of wine at the wedding. And there was a belief then that if you put down a jug of water near the fire on the night of the Epiphany, that by morning it would have changed into wine. And Willie said that he understood from his father that Garrett Barry tried this. He put down a jug of water. But according to the story, Willie said, it didn't work.
This jig is called after a famous Clare blind piper,
Garrett Barry, minor, we call it Garrett Barry G.
Although Willie did receive a lot of Garrett Barry's music, he was in his teens before he even heard a set of pipes, much less started to learn them. And when he did hear the travelling piper Johnny Doran, he was hooked for life.
I guess the direct piping influence would have come from Johnny Doran, because he visited Milltown so much. And I remember Martin Talty telling me how himself and Willie would go missing as soon as, you know, when Johnny Doran appeared in town, and they'd be missing for, you know, days, 2-3 days or whatever. But of course everyone kind of knew where they were.
I would imagine that his first real craze on pipe was Johnny Doran, because Johnny was the travelling piper that travelled so much to Milltown, or to the Milltown races. There were people from here went to the Milltown races, but just to Johnny Doran they went, you know. Paddy Murphy used to say, when they go back to the West, you could always know where you saw Johnny Doran. You saw this grand young fair-haired fellow standing behind him. That was Willie. But he had the pipes in his brain at all times, I think. You know, I think he got his first set of pipes from, or practice set from Felix, I think.
He certainly implied that Johnny was a very pleasant person. In fact, I remember a little adventure they had. Himself and Martin Talty went following Johnny around the place. I would say much to the disgust of the neighbours. especially when the three of them played together. I think Willie danced, and Talty and Doran played in Ennis Diamond one time and collected money. So I'd say that must have amused a lot of people. But on one occasion he was saying that they were camped beside the caravan in this ancient old tent, and didn't Johnny's horse put the foot through it, so they were invited into the caravan to stay in there, keep him out of the weather. Which certainly does imply a lot of decency on Johnny's part.
Yeah, Johnny Doran used to go, you see, he went to every town in Ireland. Pretty, I think he had him in Clare on many occasions. Because I remember Ted Fury telling me that he was down in Clare, and in the middle of the night, he woke up and Johnny wasn't around. They were in a caravan. And he went out to look for him, and he found him after he heard the pipes gradually went up. And here was Johnny at 4 a.m. playing to a flock of sheep. So Willie would have had experience of him. At that time, he had a mixture, a bit of Leo, but his main influence was Johnny Doran, and he always spoke about Johnny as the piper he adored.
Besides music, another fascination in Willie Clancy's life was undoubtedly the Irish language.
There was only the one thing I would disagree with Willie. He did say that he would give all his piping for the language. Well, I would not give Willie's piping for the language. Because you can learn the language if you want it, but you wouldn't learn Willie's piping. And I'm not turning down the language either. What he had was, no one else had it, where the country is full of Irish speakers. He could be that way if he wanted to and hold on to his piping.
He was saying that to try to indicate, you know, how much he loved the Irish. He actually had quite a few words of it. I think he would have liked to have been able to get more out of the poetry that his family had saved, mainly through his uncle. But the thing is that he really embodied so many different pieces of Irish culture.
I'll tell you, he didn't practice it in the sense of speaking it, but he understood it. And what I think gave him particular pleasure, and I'm quite certain of this, was when the Gaeltacht radio was started in 1972, I think. I can't remember the exact date. It must be 72, yes, because he was very, very proud of that. He listened attentively to the Gaeltacht radio. And he was so delighted, like, that this, more or less, we had our own radio with music. And while he didn't speak the language, I'm certain that he understood it, and he was great interested in words as regards, we'd say, playing the ears and things. And one of the questions we asked Willie, like, if you had to give advice, we'd say, to your musicians, what would be your advice? And his advice was, you know, about them taking their time and not to run before they could walk, but also to get and learn the Irish language, because it was so important and it was so central to the music.
His regard for the Shannon singing was very, very deep indeed. And he listened very carefully to the Shannon singers, and he brought that whole style of singing and stuff into his playing. I always think that he could speak it more of it than, you know, he ever let on. But he sure as hell understood it and understood the Shannon style of singing.
Was there a Gaeilge tradition in your home area when you were growing up? Was there Irish? Was there any Irish spoken?
Some of the old people had a quite a shade of Irish and make a lot of their remarks in Irish and think they wouldn't want us to hear that said in Irish, I suspect, you know.
How old are you, William?
54 years, come on.
And a shade, as you said earlier.
Yeah.
So, in actual fact, you learned no Irish at all from your parents when you were growing up?
No, I didn't, even though it was very much in the family. My grandfather had quite a bit of it, I believe. But somehow my father didn't have any of it, very little.
But at the same time...
They're brought out in the music, I think, you know.
This is just what I was going on about. At the same time, you can play airs, particularly slow airs, on the pipes, and give people like myself the impression that you are playing, in actual fact, Irish, rather than playing music.
I like to think that way about it. See, I'd give it all, to have the language.
Yes, yeah, his slow airs, I think they were the best piped slow airs that I ever heard. I'd be even inclined to think that they were as good, if not better, than Seamus Ennis's. But Willie's playing of slow airs was kind of frightening, you know, it was so good.
Willie Clancy came to Dublin in 1947 to win the Oireachtas piping competition, and a couple of years later he emigrated from Milltown Malbay, back to Dublin at first, but soon enough on to London.
He was in Dublin first and he met Martin Wynn, the fiddle player, and Paddy Taylor, Joe Cooley, and there was a few more that they were all in Dublin first. They went before Willie. which left didn't leave many musicians in Dublin, I think, then, you know. I'd say that was one of the reasons why he went over to London, because they were all in London that time.
His trade was as a carpenter or joiner. He had plenty of work in London, but the living conditions weren't luxurious.
There was four men in a small room about 18 by 12. We had no toilet. There was no bathroom. They'd be talking about Ireland in those days. This was in the heart of London. The only facilities we had was a bucket over in the corner, a small old cooker, gas cooker, in the other corner. We all used to have to take it in turns for cooking a breakfast or a bit of dinner in the evening. There was four in the room, Willie Clancy, myself, in one bed, and Marching Burns and a Kerry lad in the other bed. And she used to charge us, that, and now that was in 1952, she used to charge us 30 shillings each, which was £6. And that was a lot of money in 1952. So that really used to hurt Willie Clancy very, very much. And we'd have to go down to their sitting room and pay them.
The Irish fellows from the country made it to the pubs, and in Camden Town, Kentish Town, particularly at that time, that was the hub of it all. And they would just play in the evening, two or three of them, and perhaps they'd get paid, perhaps they didn't. And it was almost every night of the week. By 1956, 57, it was all over London. I had two English friends who followed the music, and we were literally the only English people who followed Irish music. Certainly, we were the only three who tried to play it. And we were freaks. I mean, we were seen as the English lads. I was introduced as the English boys, you know, in the capital of England. Here I'm introduced as an Englishman. No, it was very underground. All the pubs were run by Irish landlords. You never saw an Englishman in any of them.
Some nights would be in the Laurel Tree. I used to play with them in the Laurel Tree then. And you couldn't move on it. The music that there was terrific. Well, we didn't have far to walk. It's about a mile. This night, a copper followed us, and Martin Burns, he just detested the uniform. He used to just sweating when he'd see the coppers, you know. And this copper followed us one night from the Laurel Tree. He followed us all the way to the digs, and he stood at the door, just one side of the door, and we were directly above. And he stood there, folded his hands and stood there, and we went upstairs, and Martin Burns got a brainwave. And he said, "Roger, I want you to do something." So I said, "Yeah, what is it?" He said, "I want you to hold the wind up, because the sash cords in the window were broken." So I held the wind up for him, and he went over and he got the bucket that was in the room, and now what was in the bucket? You can imagine. And he stepped in on the bed and went out to the window and looked down and gave him the contents of the bucket, right down the top of the head, and shouted at him, "You won't follow us again." Lucky enough, we thought the squad car would be there in a matter of minutes, but there was never any word about it, and we never heard more. But what a thing to do. Oh, Willie had a hand in it as well. Oh, Willie had a hand in that. It was the talk of the place for years, Camden Town.
One of the musicians with whom Willie Clancy often played was a famous fiddler, Michael Gorman.
Michael Gorman was part of the mainstream of Irish music, but he was slightly out on the side because he'd been over since 1920, 20 years before everybody else. And he couldn't at first believe that you could play in a pub, because for 25 years he hadn't been able to play in a pub. And he got little jobs on the side. And one of the jobs he got regularly was for Ewan McColl, who sort of was starting a folk revival, if you like, and it was sort of communist led, And Michael Gorman was a wonderful profile. He was a rural worker who becomes an urban worker. I mean, it just fitted the communist profile perfectly. And McColl hooked onto this and got Michael Gorman to play at various little concerts and socials, and he brought Willie Clancy in on it. They weren't communists, of course. I mean, they knew nothing of the politics. They just knew that they were being asked to play, and they were being treated quite nicely and getting a couple of quid at the end of the engagement.
He used to love Ikey Gorman playing. He had a lovely style of playing. He had a mighty bow hand, Gorman. And he used to say to Willie, "Ah, you know, there you are." And he'd be swinging the bow, you know. "There you are now, Willie, but that's not the way I played. I played this way." And Willie used to love that.
The session was recorded in Croydon in 55 by Ewan McColl. It was part of his notion of pushing working class culture. And he'd got these two seminal musicians, and he had access to them. And there was a folk revival starting, just bursting in America. And he... I don't suppose there was a penny involved in it. McColl would have got nothing, and the two lads would have got nothing.
Always talking about home, about Milltown. He'd say, "I'm going back next month." And he used to come home for a holiday, of course. He'd come home at Easter time, maybe, or Christmas, you know. That would leave maybe about 5 years, I suppose. That was the length that he stayed in London. No way was he ever going to stay. His heart was in Milltown.
I know he came back the year of the, it was 1957. But there was a great county fly in Milltown in 1957, and he came back for that and never went back. Maybe he would have a love for home all the time, and he would have a love for what he might maybe miss when he did come back home again. He wasn't married then, like, but he got married after.
It was really, when you think of the time that Willie was in England, the 50s, you will hear him, all right, it's a great time for music, and you hear all these wonderful sessions in Camden Hall, and I've no doubt they were, but he met with a great, you know, he often spoke, you know, particularly his reference to Roger Shedlock. I remember showing him a photo, and he said many of the wonderful nights we had with that man, that rogue in London, he felt very affectionate for Roger. But that was only one thing, but maybe deep down he was never happy, because he didn't stay there that long, and when he came back after that, he never returned.
Willie Clancy spent the rest of his life, about 15 years, in Milltown Malbay. He was married to Doreen Healy, he worked as a carpenter, and many people came to visit him there, not just for his music, but also his company, his personality, and his thoughts about traditional music.
He spent his whole life, I think, thinking about it. Even whatever he was doing, there was music going through his head all the time. You'd know that because he'd be either whistling or diddling the tune, you know. I suppose if you met anyone in any kind of a trade, they would talk about the trade. But when you met Willie, it was all music. And it wasn't just music, it was people. The people who played it and how they played it and the respect he had for them, you know. And he didn't even say anyone was bad, I think.
Might he have thought it, though?
Well, sure he would have thought.
On the last occasion when we visited him, he played a particular tune. And somebody remarked that Seamus Ennis played that as well, but he didn't put as much into it as Willie did. And Willie said, "I often said it to him." He said, "You know, you could do more with that." He said, "I do like to ponder on what I'm playing and think about it. and just see how we can do that little bit more with it.
There are certain tunes that I will always associate with Willie Clancy. I remember in particular going to one of the earlier Chinnalls in Bettystown, and I always had this, and I wasn't the only one, sense of anticipation, because we knew Willie Clancy would be there, and we knew that he was going to produce something. He'd produce some new tune or tunes. And I remember the first time I heard the jig, the Eumas of Ballylochlann, and as far as I'm aware, I know that the people around me, all keen students of piping, it's the first time they ever heard it. And it was as though this was Willie's gift almost, you know, to us and to piping. Like, he gave us this new tune. But there are, you know, so many other tunes always associated with Willie Clancy. These are tunes that have a kind of an ancient, a really ancient ring about them. That was one of the most attractive things about his personality, that there was this great fun and, you know, sort of gaiety in the man. A joke was always, you know, at the ready and so on and so forth. But you were also very aware that he was deeply intuitive and, you know, he could weigh people up very, very quickly and very accurately.
Well, humorous, yes, and, you know, he was a philosophical character as well. But he was a great person to, I think, to assess. To a person who wouldn't know him, we'd say we meet him in a pub, jovial, yes, but he was always very, very quick with a comment on something, you know, and he had great respect for people whom he knew. Many of them had much the same type of personalities in that sense. They were all highly skilled people, highly intelligent people.
It was a particular tune that he played, Frater's Jig. He got this from the playing of Brother Gildas, who got it from Fraher, if I have it right. It's a single jig, and Clancy was very, very fond of it. I met him at a gig in Dublin one time, and I asked him to play that tune. Now, this was, you know, the gig was well underway. It was in a pub. There was lots of noise, you know, smoke, glasses clinking, cash register going. And he looked around and he said, "'Twould be pearls before swine. I'd play it for another time." But he was deadly. I mean, while he was great crack, there was, as you say, a very deep side to him.
He was a playful character, and he loved to tell stories and yarns and talk about people, and he had a very sort of easy way of describing things, and you could listen to him, and he had a lightheartedness. He wasn't. I know other musicians who shall be nameless who took themselves far more seriously than Willie Clancy did. He didn't push himself.
Seamus and Willie were in Queeley's, but it was in the morning time, and this little boy came in who was not, must have been down from Dublin or somewhere, and Willie was actually at the time in behind the bar. This was before the Iron Lung, pulling a pint out of the wooden barrel. So he wasn't visible. And Seamus, as quick as lightning, said to the little boy, "Did you ever see a whistle played through the ear?" And he put it up, and of course Willie had the whistle, and Willie played, which was fine. The little boy was deeply impressed. The trouble was that about 15 minutes later, when Willie was out now and had emerged into the bar, he came back with his whole family for another demonstration. And Seamus said, "Oh, I can only do it once a day. It's very hard on the eardrums."
Willie Clancy also played the fiddle, lilted, danced, and was a good singer.
I remember hearing what some people would regard as a sentimental potboiler, as Stormy McCree, but he loved it and he was tremendous singing it. He went, there was apparently a plane crashed somewhere down near Milltown Malbay, and the whole population headed out to look at this, but he had arranged to go meet an aunt of his to learn off Stormy McCree. So off he toddled, learned the song, while the rest of the population went to look at this crashed airplane. He was a good singer. And he was madly interested in song.
Storm McCree, when you're far away from the home that you'll soon be leaving, it's many the time by night and by day that your heart will be sorely grieving, for the stranger's land may be bright and fair, and rich in her treasures golden, you'll pine, I know, for the long, long ago, and the love that is never olden.
Oh, Willie sang well and he danced well. He even danced the ordinary Caledonian set, but he as himself says, he threw the step of a step dancing as well. When I saw him dancing, I said, this is how Willie plays the tune when he's diddling it to himself or to anyone else, you know. Well, all he did with his feet, inside and 3 square feet of ground, he would, and he was done like that with his feet. And I said, that's how you play the tunes, you know. If he was playing a tune for you or like that, that's the way he would play it, whether it would be jig or reel. I'm sure he would do the same thing with dancing a reel, you know.
He wasn't a drinker either, you know. He'd only just take a bottle of Guinness, maybe 3 or 4 bottles. If someone, of course, it was a treat that time to buy a whiskey, he'd have an odd whiskey. But he was never a drinker. Never, no.
The last time I saw Willie was, somehow or other, I got the message that he was in a bad way, and I made an appointment for him with the cardiologist in Vincent's, and I went down to see him, and he came out of the house looking very bad, and I told him, and he agreed he'd come up. So, but that was literally the last time I saw him.
The week actually that he got the attack, I've been below in Freels with Sean Reid, and we were inside in the kitchen and we were talking about, Willie was playing, and Sean was talking about, they were looking forward, this was in the month of either the beginning of January or the end of December, I'm not sure the exact time, but what he was looking forward to at the time was going to the next Tin Hole. But he was going to Mass, it was Sunday morning, and on the way up to Mass, he got the attack. It followed from that then, that he finished up in the intensive care in Galway, and he was there for 3 weeks. And from the very outset, the doctor who was looking after it held out no hope at all.
My wife was working in the county hospital nursing at the time, and she came home one morning and she said, Willie's inside. At that time, we didn't know how serious or what it was, you know, but she said to Willie, I'll tell him come in. Do, he said, I might have something to lave him.
I was sharing a house with Seamus Ennis at the time, and news came through anyway that Willie wasn't well and that he was in hospital in Galway. So Seamus decided we must go over to Galway immediately and visit him. And we set off over to Galway. And we arrived at the, I think it was the regional hospital, and we weren't let in, and Seamus was very upset at that, naturally enough. And he had a book, I can't remember the name of it, a detective novel. And on the inside of the cover was, "Willie, don't forget the ghost see, Seamus and Liam." And we never did get to see him, and he died shortly after that.
I didn't realise until he was dead that everyone in Milltown knew he was finished. Because then I went back there the night he died, and they were planning the mass, and they said, "You're playing at it." And I said, "Is it planned already?" They said, "It's planned with a week." The funny thing, myself and Seamus Innes played at it. The two of us. It was a lonesome time around here, I can tell you, when Willie passed on.
I was really shocked when I heard he died. He was very happily married there, you know. He had all his relations and all his friends there. And he was playing well that time. And he was only a young man, sure, when he died. He died in 73. He'd be in his 50s. About 54, 55, it's probably been.
The funeral itself, you had musicians here from all over Ireland. Every, you know, and a lot of people who are non-musicians, out of respect for Emery, and a lot of people are from different parts of Cork, Connemara, Galway. And I remember Marty Malley, in the composition he had, they came from Troubled Belfast and down and up from Sweet Coolay. It was the composition he had at the time on it. But there were so many musicians that could be from everywhere. Like, it just proved that the appreciation of Willie, probably even among the local community. It's often said that a prophet is not appreciated in his own land, but obviously Willie was highly thought of as a musician.
At his funeral, Seamus Ennis was to speak, and Seamus was there, and it was a very wet day. And people sort of saying, you know, "Happy is the bride, the sun shines on, and happy is the corpse that the rain falls on." Shanachar.
Oh yes, the day of his funeral, myself and Ivor Brown carried the coffin. We were first out of the church. In fact, that nearly led to my being sacked, because I was still out sick. And how I didn't get pneumonia out of it, I don't know. It was pouring with rain every inch of the way to the graveyard, and all the time while he was being buried. A tremendous occasion in one sense, but I could not and still can't see it like that. I think it was actually quite a shock to the people of Milltown Malby to realise that he was quite so well known and so well loved and appreciated by people in all walks of life, from all parts of the country and from outside the country as well. But a dreadful, dismal day. Seamus Ennis played in the church, but you know, it's still a bad memory for me.
My biting memory of it, I remember the guy's music, would be Tommy Potts. I remember Tommy Potts playing that day, it was below in Fields. That still stands out, of Tommy Potts.
Tommy Potts played in Fields, crying down on his fiddle. And that is true. He just turned his back on everyone and he left the fiddle away. You know, it would kill you. That incident alone, that it had that effect in Tommy, you know. But Willie lived in Tommy's house, you know. And Tommy had a fiddle, belonged to him, a beautiful fiddle. It was a rich, powerful fiddle.
Another extraordinary thing I remember was, I think it was again in Freels. Anyway, Tommy Potts playing the fiddle and playing "My Love Is in America." And he was facing the wall and tears streaming down his face.
Are there many young people in Clare at the moment taking an interest in music?
Well, not so many in the instruments that I'd like him to see. I'd like to see them take an interest in. They're more or less in the accordions, you know. Well, the accordions are, right, but one would like to see them taking up the flutes or the pipes or the fiddles and that kind of thing, you know. Because it's very hard to be a charitable performer with the power of an accordion at your disposal, you know. You can drown out everybody, and of course, that's, well, that's natural enough to, especially in a big place, to play like that. And
yeah. What sort of advice would you give to someone taking up the pipes about how to go about them?
Biggest trouble I see with fellas taking up flutes or fiddles or pipes, that they're trying to play it too quickly. They want to do the ABC stage of it, or learning to walk like a child at all. You know, they want to play it straight away. They're not satisfied, in other words, with their efforts. I suppose it is hard to be, so that's to come back to the same thing. You'd be better off to learn while the brain is young and the fingers are young, and you'll be satisfied with your efforts when you're young.
He wasn't a man for PR. Or wasn't interested in PR. In fact, I'll be honest about it. With the summer school after, I often felt the same way. We weren't people either for that type of PR business. That we, you know, if a thing hadn't the depth and the substance to retain it, there was no point in putting a glossy coating on it and a sugar coating on it if it hadn't the intellectual depth to sustain it. That's very, very, and I think Willie was much that way, that he said little, but you'd know from the comment that he would make whether he approved or disapproved of something.
I think Willie has left a huge legacy to the world of piping. The man and his music, they're sort of, you know, completely, totally intertwined. And I think the Willie Clancy Summer School, which is, you know, probably the most important traditional music event in the calendar, is a very fitting monument to Willie Clancy. I think Willie Clancy himself would have, if he knows what's going on in his name down in Milltown, he'll get a huge kick out of it, because he'll see us down there with tremendous hangovers. He'll delight in the fact that we're really enjoying ourselves. It's something that if he was around, he'd be in the thick of it anyway.
I still miss him all these years later. There's been a major hole in my life since Willie died. I still feel his presence. I still, you know, when I think about him, I don't think about him all the time. I mean, I'm not going around moping, I can tell you that. He'd give me a right kick in the backside if he thought I was. But when I think of him, I still can feel a presence there. You know, it's a shame, because he'd be in his 80s now. He could still be playing away.
On the one hand, he was what we'd call a working class tradesman. On the other hand, he had this deep love of Ireland and considerable depth to even his knowledge of mythology. And I mean, in England on the building, he would have been just a paddy, but he was totally different. Which is this strange thing in Irish country life that was there, that on the one hand you had a poverty, and on the other you had this deeper dimension of a tradition going right back to bards. So Willie would have had some of that feeling in him.
Contributors to that programme were Roger Sherlock, Peter O'Loughlin, Pat Mitchell, Liam O'Flynn, Marisha Rockoyne, Ivor Brown, Bridget Clancy, Reg Hall, Kieran McMahuna, Tony Kearns, Jimmy O'Brien Moran, Dave Hegarty, and some visitors to the Willie Clancy Summer School in 2002. The archive interviews were by Michael O'Donnell and Brendan O'Quivine. Willie Clancy played the pipes and tin whistles, and the fiddlers were Michael Gorman and Tommy Potts. Lashings of Music was presented and produced by Peter Brown.